Thanks for reminding us how important it is to feed the human spirit, and what an important part of modern architecture that really is. I'd like to invite our next speaker, L. Mark Taylor, architect, head of the Caribbean School of Architecture. Mark had the distinction of starting his practice of architecture at the age of 15. And if you know Mark, then you will believe that. He started at McMorris Sibley Robinson, and from there he went on to the Architectural Association School of Architecture. He finished there and worked in London, in England, before returning to Jamaica in 1982. He worked for the UDC, so he had his stint in the public sector, before starting his own firm in 1989, and simultaneously starting to teach at the Caribbean School of Architecture, which I think had found its true legs and in that year. And he has worked consistently, I believe, in the design studio, and is largely responsible for the training of architects who are now entering the profession in Jamaica and in the wider Caribbean. So please help me to welcome Mark Taylor.
Thank you, Margaret.
I need to say that he's the head of the Caribbean School of Architecture.
Okay, my presentation today begins armed with a view that architecture must have a context to be relevant, and that that context has a history. What I'm about to present is being presented for the first time in Jamaica. Our history of looking at our architecture is not as old as Latin America. In fact, we've just had a school since 1987, and the archives of many of the architects haven't even been open to us. So what I'm going to do is to give you largely a slideshow after I painted a context for you. The critique of this work has not yet been done. Maybe we'll start making some of that today. A lot of this has happened in private conversations. This is the first time I'm going public. So today I'm coming out. Conscious that many of you have never been to Jamaica before, and you don't know the setting, I thought it very important to show you where we are located. That's a map of Jamaica, which has a very mountainous spine, and Kingston is here in the southeast corner. Kingston has the ideal setting. It's classical and textbook perfect. It is located in paradise at the center of the world. It has the Blue Mountains to the north and the Caribbean Sea to the south, protected by a natural sheltered harbor. When you came in, you'd have come into the airport right here, out on the Palisades, and you'd have gone around and you'd have looked across the sea, the Kingston waterfront, which is sitting right here. And New Kingston, and this is where we are now, we're down on the Kingston waterfront. And New Kingston, where you're staying, is actually right here. And the University of Technology is somewhere just up here, near to the Mono Reservoir. It's very important that you understand that context, because most of my talk is going to center around Kingston. But I'm actually really talking about the birth of a nation. Jamaica was unaffected by the incipient modern movement in Europe, in architecture, which emerged during World War I, actually. And it appeared from 1914 to 1945, which heralded great changes in architectural thinking. It was largely unknown to Jamaicans. And so it inspired really no imitators. Before World War II, most Jamaicans were isolated physically from the international trends, which overseas travel, with overseas travel at the time being mainly by banana boats. But as you look at that image, you'll actually see that airplanes used to actually land on the harbor just outside your windows. And That's the sort of thing. It took one day to actually get to New York, so I think most of you feel quite happy that you can actually get there now in a few hours, because it had to actually hop along. The background to a modern Kingston actually starts before the date that I'm looking at. It actually starts in 1907, when there was a devastating earthquake. Now, Kingston had been subject to many hurricanes and previous earthquakes, but nothing as devastating as this. And in 1907, following the earthquake, there was a great fire, which actually destroyed the city, and you can see some images there. It actually precipitated then a change in the building laws. It seems that the British colonials didn't learn the lessons before this time, and so they had to get a strong reminder of what nature could do. After this, they started building in concrete. The laws actually required that you now built in materials more durable. The houses of the wealthy started to be built in concrete, and the public buildings were built in concrete. That is just an example of a merchant's place in 1936 on the left, and examples of a middle-class residence, which was still framed in timber time with different infill materials and rendered over with lime or cement plaster. Cement at the time, of course, being imported into Jamaica. Rupture with the past and the beginnings of new attitudes to building and design can be traced to quite specific occurrences. This must be viewed against the backdrop of a colonial post-slavery society undergoing rapid social change and upheavals. Now, this is the period between the wars. With a small ruling elite, educated, urbane, and sophisticated, atop a largely rural, alienated, illiterate, an unsophisticated population, intermittently employed and without a worldview. Notwithstanding the Garvey movement, which was the exception, and really before its time, and at the time really was not accepted in Jamaica. 1938 in Jamaica saw great social unrests and riots beginning on the sugar estates, and it brought with it the sort of birth of our modern political structure, with two of our national heroes emerging after this time. Between 1939 and 1945, World War II in Europe sucks manpower from the colonies to fight for the cause in Europe. 1944, Jamaicans get the right to vote under universal adult suffrage, and the Kingston population swells, and at 237,000 represents a quarter of a half of the national total. I'm showing works of art that are contemporary or just outside the period. The top one is Edna Manley's Negro Aroused, which came in 1935 and actually expresses the feeling of the time. And below that you have Albert Huey, actually looking at sugarcane crops in the 1950s. In the 1940s, the airport was built actually during the war by the British forces, and it opens immediately after the war to traffic, and this starts to become, we start to get more people coming into Jamaica after that time. Easier travel. People continue leaving the countryside to find work in the city. Slums grow, huge slums grow, mainly to the west of the city, on the outskirts, and it puts pressure on the authorities for them to create new employment. At the same time, you get mass migration to the United States and the United Kingdom in particular, right after the war. In the 1950s, Jamaicans begin returning from overseas. These are people who fought in the war and people who went overseas immediately after the war to get further education. They bring with them an expanded worldview and expectations for a better life. I don't think this was different anywhere on earth. We know that this is the case for many, certainly for blacks in the United States at the time. They demand an improved social and physical infrastructure and modern housing for everyone. There are some important things that happened in this time, and we need to understand them because they are critical to the building of Jamaica, a modern country. During between 1949 and 59, in that decade, the colonial government understands that to create employment, they have to change the paradigms that existed before this. Before this, nothing was manufactured in Jamaica, and it was almost a requirement. We were a raw material supplier. We supplied things to the mother country, and they produced things and sold it back to us at 10 times the price. After that, after the war, they realized that it couldn't hold. And so there was a change in the laws, and the pioneer industrial laws started to be created. This encouraging industrial development, new jobs, and it spurs an entrepreneurial feeling within the country. Right after this, or during this period, Hurricane Charlie hits Jamaica, and it destroys the housing. The British government gives a grant of $1.2 million and a loan of just over $1 million. Nothing is done with this money for some time, and in typical Jamaican fashion, just before the period runs out, the government realizes we have to act or we lose the money. So they decide, well, we need to form relationships with the private sector. And their handcrafted ways of building houses up to that time just couldn't work. So they start to create partnerships with the private sector. The cement company, local cement company, comes into being around 1952, and cement production begins. On the right, you have the then president of the Jamaican Manufacturers Association, Mr. Aaron Matalan, with Senator Adlai Stevenson actually opening a factory in Jamaica. And this is symbolic, again, of the time. New industries coming. And below that, a painting by Carl Pabu Singh and the cement company, which actually inspired even artists. In 1952, we get the return to the island of the first Jamaican architect. This is Wilson Champ. 1959, we have the start of the Mona Heights housing scheme. Now, this is critical. The subdivision of Nuxall Park, which was a racetrack in the middle of the city, and it's the same area that you're staying right now, if you're staying in New Kingston. And it gets subdivided to allow a new city to be built uptown. It gives the opportunity for showcasing Jamaican architectural talent on a large scale. In 1962, we get independence from Britain. That is the Mona Heights housing scheme, which is right across from the University of Technology. And around the same time, the Mona Reservoir is built, which is important for keeping, for expanded water supply for the growing city. Below, that is a place that presently houses our parliament. This context has now disappeared. I don't know whether to say fortunately or unfortunately, but you can actually see the rupture. That was a prevailing architecture, and this is what actually followed. And that's Gordon House, the present Parliament building of Jamaica. And it's presently a great debate as to whether the building should remain there or should move somewhere else to create a greater national symbol. In 1968, the Urban Development Corporation is formed and begins work on redeveloping the Kingston waterfront, this place where we now are. The wharves are relocated to the west of the city. That's work going on, reclaiming land. And that's pictures of the old finger piers of downtown Kingston, and this is what has actually happened, and we're somewhere in here. 1975 to 76, the Jamaican economy implodes, bringing the imposition of a three-day week and major cutbacks in building activities. This presages a migration of Jamaican professionals and artisans. So from this great two decades of Jamaican architecture and building, 1975, things start to implode, everyone leaves. I'm going to actually now talk about those two decades. And I'm going to talk about something else, because my thing is about concrete expressions. Concrete expressions here refer to the material, and it also refers to the expressions of the Jamaican people. From the 1960s, concrete, the ubiquitous wonder material with great plastic qualities, durable, strong, inexpensive, versatile, beloved of the master builder, becomes a material of choice. Becomes a material of choice of the everyman. This was socially desirable, but largely disastrous results for the aesthetic environment. Equiano, the 18th century African who escaped slavery in Britain, in telling of his life in Ebo in West Africa, says that in the construction of houses, every man is a sufficient architect for the purpose. And it is this attitude which empowers the people in the construction of their dwellings. The dominance of concrete construction has caused the government to measure the health of the building industry in Jamaica through cement sales. As a result, our modern built and architectural legacy is almost overwhelmingly in concrete. There are no examples of major steelworks since the 19th century in Jamaica, where we have two of the best examples to be found anywhere on earth. And timber we use really for the roofs. There are a couple notable examples. Up to World War II, professional expertise is provided overwhelmingly by expatriates and contract to the colonial government. Prior to 1952, the architectural practice in Jamaica were only two, Ashwell and Rose and Norman and Dauban, both of whom are of British origin. The piece at the bottom is the buildings for the National Library Service, which were done by Ashwell, Harold Ashwell, with a different partner. I think it was done in the 1950s. 1947, which is really where we start marking what we consider modern architecture in Jamaica. Norman and Dauban were invited to plan and design University College of the West Indies and the Medical School. They exposed Jamaicans to the modernist trends sweeping Europe and beginning to conquer the USA. Advertising overseas for architects, they attract many short-stay professionals, including a young Arthur Gensler, who, as some of you may know, went on to form one of the largest practices on earth. From 1953, the firm expands activities in Jamaica, designing the buildings for the two international airports in Kingston and Montego Bay. Through name and professional changes, the firm in Jamaica becomes Rakowski, Bradford & Partners in the 1960s and APEC Consultants in the 1970s. The 20 years between 55 and 75 have been called the golden years of Jamaican development and architecture, when professionals were considered worthy and treated with respect. It was also a time with a lot of work for qualified professionals. The first of the dominant players in these decades is architect Wilson Chong. Much of his work, much of it is still there. The slide at the top right, unfortunately, has been demolished. But the rest of the work is still here, but not well maintained. He was an innovator who explored the possibilities of concrete as a plastic material, manipulating it into a variety of shapes, from cantilevers to shell forms to textile blocks. Playful but legible, restless and experimental. Just showing some of the works. From Le Corbusier, as I said, to Felix Candela. This is his masterpiece, which has not been well maintained. But it's one of the closest buildings we get to iconographic status in Jamaica, and it's the National Stadium, which he obviously conceived as a cathedral for sport. There's an old aerial photograph on the left. It was made into a stamp for the 1966 Commonwealth Games, and there's a contemporary photograph of the back of the grandstand. McMorris Sibley Robinson are without doubt the preeminent Jamaican architectural practice. They dominated the field in the second half of the 20th century, and their great output and high standards are a testament to their ability. Founded in 1955, Vid McMorris, Jeremy Sibley, and later on Herbert Robinson. And they were seemingly modeled, we can have the conversation another time, on the American corporate practice of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill. While churning out some of the most exciting architecture in Jamaica at the time, they acted as incubators of young talent, guiding many of the country's present architects through their apprenticeship. At its peak, they undertook work throughout the Caribbean, and they worked a lot in collaboration with firms, including firms from North America and other islands. They will always be remembered as purveyors of excellence in architecture, exhibiting high professional standards and producing work of consistent quality. That building at the bottom is next door, and you can see it at any time. It's the headquarters of Scotiabank in Jamaica. I'm just going to show you some images of some of the medium rise and low rise work that they did. But they're also probably the architects, most of these are around New Kingston, and some of these are by the University of the West Indies. The one on the right is actually on the north coast and is a hotel extension. But they're mainly known for their high rise buildings. Before them, most buildings in Kingston or Jamaica may have been 2 to 3 floors, almost never higher than that. And you can see what they've done to the modern skyline, both on the waterfront and in New Kingston. These are buildings in New Kingston and just outside. The one on the left is an apartment building sitting on a base, and again, it's next door. These also just up from your hotel in New Kingston. They're very well maintained, which is an important thing to say in Jamaica, because much of the buildings, even new ones, are not particularly well maintained. This is some of the architecture they did. That's the Jamaica School of Agriculture on the left. That's the auditorium, cafeteria for the University of Technology, the Norman Manley Law School, and the winning design for the Cayman Law Courts. Another important person is H. Denny Repole. His buildings cover just about every type, and they all have a clear, articulated expression, with Frank Lloyd Wright always being present, while always being respectful and understanding of human scale and local culture. Denny is a great Jamaican. He has won two competitions for national monuments. On the right, there's the one to one of our national heroes, Paul Bogle, and George William Gordon. The other's churches, apartment buildings, commercial buildings, and offices, private houses. Design collaborative. I have to just give an overview, folks. There's just plenty of it. In the mid-1970s, four young architects, Evan Williams, Patrick Staniger, David Twiss, and Steve Mendez, formed Design Collaborative. They make an immediate impact, winning many awards, including designs for the Cultural Training Center in the McIntyre Lands. That's an overview of the Cultural Training Center, which again you pass on your way back to your hotel probably, and there's a detailed photograph of it. And many of our artists in dance and arts, the performing arts, train right there. The government architects of that period, they're never named, but they performed sterling work. That building on the left is the Cornwall Regional Hospital in Montego Bay. It was designed by the Architects Collaborative out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they worked with local architects and the people who worked at the time at the Public Works Department with the ministry. Bottom, the dental school. Big building in Montego Bay. Again, designed overseas, but working in collaboration with local architects. The architect was Roy Stevenson. Architecture on the right, I believe, we're not sure, but I think that's Chalmers Gibbs, top right. And the one at the bottom is a little theater, which has been changed much since then. And I'm still working on the name of the person who did it. But it's been modified somewhat, but still very much being used. Montilla Latima from Puerto Rico on the left, and our National Arena to the right, top, Sharon Morrison, and again, British firm, lower right, the Kingston Pegasus, which I believe is the building you're staying in. Urban Development Corporation, come into being in 1968. Kingston Waterfront, later on in the 80s, they start also doing rural urban development. They become really big in the three decades after my period. What I'm about to say is probably the most important part of the presentation, so Margaret won't cut me just now. It has become a cliche in architecture that to create good work requires architects of skill and vision, a competent professional team, supportive clients, and skilled builders and craftsmen. In a modern context, it also requires a healthy economy and an entrepreneurial spirit, as architecture is very expensive to produce. It is in the successful mixing of these ingredients that good work emerges, and Jamaica was fortunate in having this blend during two decades of growth between 55 and 75. Many of the architects, building professionals, developers, and clients have contributed to Jamaican architecture in this period. Too numerous to mention, but some are worthy of recollection. One of the earliest returning Jamaican professionals developed into the ultimate architect's engineer. Tommy Leo has probably worked with every practicing architect in Jamaica and is as responsible as anyone for the fine shaping of the built environment, emulating and employing the lessons of his former employer, Ove Arup, the brilliant Danish-British engineer. Like artists, architects also need good patrons to support their work. McMorris Sibley Robinson had an outstanding client, or has, in businessman Maurice Facy of Pan-Jamaican Investments. A large portion of their portfolios have been realized through working together, and the face of New Kingston and the Kingston Waterfront have been shaped by this long-standing partnership. They've also promoted numerous joint venture professional liaisons with highly successful results. Again, this building is next door. And on the right, you can see some of what Old Kingston looked like and some of what the new city became. Ainsworth David Scott was a Renaissance man who affected a wide area of Jamaican life. An engineer by training, he returned to the island from Montreal, where he had already made a mark as a talented structural engineer. And with his diverse activities, he personified the new Jamaican spirit. Performing as engineer, builder, entrepreneur, businessman, art patron, connoisseur and collector, and sometimes architect and artist, he made contributions to the construction of the National Stadium, Hope Reservoir, UWI Chapel, Kingston Sheraton Hotel. He was also the designer, builder, owner of the Olympia International Arts Center and Hotel, which he opened in 1964 as a place for local artists to showcase their work. That's it at the top right. West Indies Home Contractors. They were actually formed in 1958 by the Matalan family. And they have a vision that says they must be able to provide a home for every Jamaican. You've seen that slide already. It's Mona Heights. Mona houses were built using a precast concrete system from Puerto Rico. And it revolutionized Jamaican housing and construction. They had flat concrete slab roofs, terrazza tile floors, aluminium louvered windows, with a modern styling which appealed to young professionals and civil servants. The streets were well designed with ample paved sidewalks, planting strips, precast concrete, street lighting poles, underground electrics, everything that you might think is modern and refreshing, unlike the Kingston which you presently see, which still has lights and cables flying overhead. They're enjoying their 50th anniversary coming up pretty soon, or is it this year? And they're still producing work. They produced nearly 40,000 homes in Jamaica alone. That our artists even paint their experience. That is a painting about Duhaney Park. That's on the left, their basic unit, at the bottom, an expanded version, and that's just an overflight. Patrick Stanigar, I've been told to move. Patrick Stanigar designed this building, and he's been uncannily in the right place at the right time. He has worked with McMorris Sibley Robinson, the design collaborative, he was a founding partner, the Urban Development Corporation, where he created this building. And he does most of the major work for West Indies Home Contractors. He's unclassifiable stylistically. He's a relentless searcher for appropriate form through the matching of systems, resources, and place. He's the first and only dean of the Caribbean School of Architecture. Jamaica, I'm just going to run through these quickly, so I'll take another 2 minutes. Theater, speech, dance, music, art, sport. The Caribbean School of Architecture, after 1975, the School of Architecture, passing of the Architects Registration Act. And paradoxically, something I must say, most large architecture projects now are being done by overseas firms. As I said, it's a paradox, because now for the first time we export fully trained architects to the world, from China to the Middle East, North America, Britain. We export them, and the country imports architects to do the projects. Well, Kingston population is now 870,000. Certainly from 19, it's about 900,000 now, and a third of the population of the entire country resides in this city. Contrast from then till now. Architect's office then, architect's office now. A lot more modest, but still, you know, full of style. Images of the Caribbean School of Architecture. That's our future. Half the people in this room are students or graduates of the Caribbean School of Architecture. Quick word, We're looking at the future. Marvin Goodman has been here for 50 years soon. And it's a testament to what he does that he remains relevant. In fact, he's giving us pointers to what the future can be. Headlines. These are headlines this month. Caribbean governments must prepare for global warming. $18 million bill shocks resorts. That's a one-month bill for a hotel. 1 month energy bill. Jamaican dollars, just divided by 72, it's still a big bill. On the left, I mean, that's an interesting contrast, the buildings you've passed. But is it just about image and surface? Or is it about deeper things? They're right next to each other, so you can stand and look at them. And two of the firms I've talked about, they're here. I hope they talk to me afterwards. But they're right next to each other. Last one. David Harrison, former dean of the School of Architecture. And I'm busting it. There's a need for commitment from the profession to principles which we hold dear. We need to commit. Sustainable ways of living on the planet is now a universal cry. You can't go to a conference and not talk about sustainability. But by our response to this, we should be judged. David Harrison's house, which he built for himself in the St. Andrew Hills, is an exemplary example of such a commitment. That's it. He provides everything for himself, and he lives a very decent life. This is the last slide. I'm just going to read it. You can read with me. The decline in urban living conditions parallels the fall of the prestige of the architect. Architecture's consumer product and fashion image now supplants its social purpose, which had provided the energy since the 1920s. The vanity of a misplaced Baroque splendor, sitting alongside the workers' medieval incrustations, builds onto the basic boxes which provide a toehold on the ladder of sanity, if not respectability. The places in between these areas of love must concern us as the main professional designers of the built environment, for this is the public zone. The work of the golden decades is confident and may even be sometimes assertive, but hardly ever bombastic or brash, even if a little too certain. In these concrete expressions, if they make strong gestures in their settings, and maybe they should have been a little more poised, balancing the certainty of our youth with the certainty, with the uncertainty of the future. But that was not a time for humility, because we've been colonials for too long. Two interesting images, the incrustations, and an artist's view from 2004 about what we do with our urban environment. Thank you very much.